Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. There are very few of us who have not experienced or will not experience low back pain. Most people with acute low back pain will improve within a month or two, but recurrences are common. For a few, low back pain, however, becomes chronic. This Line One program will deal with the origin, the evaluation, treatment, and prevention of low back pain. And this is from the perspective of an authority on the biomechanics of the human back, Dr. Stuart McGill. Dr. McGill is professor of spine biomechanics and director of spine biomechanics laboratory there at the University of Waterloo in Ontario, Canada. So this is the second time Dr. McGill has graciously agreed to be on the program, and he spent most of his professional life studying the function of the human back, the origin of back problems, and the most reliable methods to rehabilitate injury. Dr. McGill, thanks very much for taking the time to be with us again today.
Buttered.
All right. You're still breaking up slightly. I just want you to know we'll keep working on it. We've had some engineering issues, but so those of you who are listening, hang in there. We're going to keep trying to work on that. You know what? The way I'd like to start this, I had a question down about your training, but you know what I'm more interested in, I think, is how your training differs from that of, let's say, physicians, orthopedic surgeons, chiropractors, physical therapists, and so forth. What has your training been that's brought you to this understanding of the spine?
Well, first of all, how am I sounding now?
You sound very good again.
Okay, fantastic. Well, I trained and got my PhD in biomechanics of the spine. And after that, we would begin asking a few basic questions about how the spine worked and how it became injured. And then we would get invited to different meetings, orthopedic meetings, neurology meetings, lumbar spine meetings, etc. And clinicians would say, that's very interesting what you just described in terms of that mechanism. Would you see a particularly challenging patient for us? And I would say, well, not really. I'm not trained as a clinician. And they said, well, don't worry. We will accompany you. And I started to see patients and realized that I came at this in a totally different way and with quite a different set of training. So I ended up now medical schools and different institutions will ask me to come in and assess back pain patients in front of their clinicians and their fellows and whatnot. And most of the time they say, wow, we don't quite think that way, but I provoke the tissues that are causing pain to see if I can increase the pain. And then immediately I try and unload the tissue, be it a nerve or a joint capsule or a disc or an implant, and then see if the pain decreases. So right away we get a proof and a match of the specific pain trigger and an approach immediately to start reducing the symptoms. And the tools that we use are biomechanical. They are motions, postures, and loads. And because of our work, we've systematically gone through, tried to develop techniques to load specific tissues. And that, in a nutshell, is how we got to be this hybrid between the clinical world and the scientific world.
You know, when we first talked a couple of years ago, I had begun to read some of the reports and articles that you had published on your research and became aware that one of the big changes in how you thought about the spine was this flexibility was not necessarily good, but actually harmful, particularly to the intervertebral discs. My understanding is you'd come to that conclusion from very specific research in your lab that found that flexibility, that increasing motion actually injured the spine more than it helped it. And I'm thinking of things like I grew up learning is doing sit-ups and so forth were not so good, and that you then moved into a whole different way of thinking about spine stability. And I now find that that is very commonly thought of when I talk to all kinds of people involved in the therapy of the back. And it makes me think it all originated from the stuff, that, some of the work that you were doing in your lab.
I'll take some of the credit for that, but I've certainly had my critics over the years as well. But our textbooks are having an impact, and maybe the viewers would be, or not your viewers, but your listeners would be interested in knowing that we will tackle virtually any controversial subject that has to do with the low back. Our investigations really have a four-prong approach, or levels of investigation. We do basic science, for example. So when you were talking about the mobility stability continuum in the disc, we take real discs and we try and create the various injuries, be it end plate fracture or disc herniation. And then we will perform applied tests and see if we can then provoke those tissues, move into the clinical world and see if they are effective, and take the pain away on individual patients, and then finally into the epidemiological world, where we will get a test group, like a group at risk, maybe a group of firefighters, for example, and follow them for a few years, which we have done, both firefighters and police groups, military, sports groups, etc. So with those four levels of approach, I can give you specific examples of any one of those if you wish, but that's how we might come to a reasonable conclusion about this mobility-stability continuum and what produces healthy performance versus a painful disabled back.
Yeah, you know, I would like to take the time to give us some example. And I guess the primary reason I'm doing this is one of the things I've constantly tried to do on this program is give people a good understanding that it's very important to get good evidence, and not only just evidence. It's increasingly important to understand that there's really the best evidence. There's a lot of evidence for some things, but some of that evidence isn't so good. And I really do gravitate to people like yourself that are really looking very hard objectively to get the right answers to these problems. So if you don't mind, give us an example of something that that you guys have done in your lab.
Well, I can give you our recent work in those four categories that I just described. So let's take a clinical question. And as you know, I listen a lot to clinicians, what their clinical concerns are, because they form our next question. I had heard a number of years ago that every frontline clinician will be approached by a patient who says, after sex 3 months ago, we've now been celibate. We are so fearful of knackering our backs again, and yet the clinicians told me, we all hear this and we have no guidelines as to what to tell the patients. So what we did, for the first time ever, we took 15 couples, and believe it or not, we measured them in having sex in different positions, using different techniques. We measured spine load, hip load, knee load, etc. And then we created an atlas. So the clinician now would assess the patient and determine if their pain triggers are flexion-induced or extension or motion-induced or compression or shear-induced, and then look up on the atlas as to which positions avoid that particular pain trigger. So there's an example of how we go about asking questions, and one at the clinical level. And I might also add on that, that was the most successful media release in the history of the university. We were front page on The Economist, newspapers in Costa Rica, Norway, Italy, China, totaling a readership of 3.6 billion people. In any case, that is a clinical example. A basic example, we just recently showed how the big three stabilization exercises that we developed through an evidence gathering approach in the 90s, those three exercises, when you perform them, they create a residual stiffness in the spine that lasts for an hour or two or even three in certain people. So some docs and clinicians, physios, have been saying, when we give those exercises to patients, they report feeling better for a few hours afterwards. And we wondered what the mechanism was. Well, one of the mechanisms is the residual stiffness from those exercises, and I'm talking about a good stiffness now, it actually engineers micro movements out of a joint. So if a joint has lost a little bit of disc height, it's inherently unstable or sloppy, the stiffness will take out some of those pain-triggering micro movements. Are you still with me?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, from an applied approach, we continually work on specific tests for pain provocation. Pain provocations of specific motions, postures, and loads, because that's what patients understand. They understand that when I move this way under that load, that triggers my pain. Oh, that happens when I brush my teeth. So in that sense, we can show them what their pain triggers are with very specific motions, postures, and loads, and then show them how to move in a way to avoid those pain triggers. And then we develop pain provocation of very specific tissues. So that goes right back to our roots in biomechanics. How do you load a facet joint in compression and in shear and in tension? How do you ballistically load the M plate of the disc to simulate a patient walking along and treading into a pothole or something like that? The last prong of evidence gathering will be epidemiological. We won an award, actually, for the best publication in the Ergonomics Journal last year. We followed the elite task force of the Toronto Police Force for 5 years. The hypothesis going into that study was those fitter police officers would have less back pain. It turned out not to be true. And we have also replicated this in athletic groups, doing different styles of training, and in firefighters, 1,200 firefighters. And as it turned out, you might get a kick out of this. Do you know where the most dangerous place a police officer can be in terms of musculoskeletal injury?
Sitting in their car.
Well, it's actually in the training room.
All right.
The more fit police officers, firefighters, and military are doing training to the extreme.
Uh-huh.
This notion on the internet that, oh, you should first do 10 burpees followed by 10 Olympic lifts is somehow going to make your body more injury resilient. And we're finding exactly the opposite, and we now have the evidence for this.
Huh.
You might be temporarily more fit, and you will test fitter on a fitness test. However, it appears that your fitness will be shorter lived, and you will become injured sooner. So there's actually a sweet spot in terms of fitness. You can be too strong and you can be too weak. There's a sweet spot right in the middle, and it's the same for just about every athletic variable, whether it be mobility, flexibility, endurance, etc. So the more fit you are, the closer you are to that knife edge of injury. The margin of safety actually decreases, as it does when you become very weak or deficient in any of these
right.
as well. Anyway, there's just an example of some recent work that we've done in the four pillars of evidence.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And just to make sure our listeners are also aware that you have gotten into high peak performance. And so what I've heard you just say is that you can overtrain, you can be too weak. Both of those increase your risk of problems. But there is also, it seems to me, you've made a study of how to get peak performance and not have so much trouble with injuries. Am I overstating where another aspect of your research is gone?
No, I think that's very fair to say. As you know, we deal with quite disabled backs, but we also, for some reason, we get a lot of very elite athletes who come for consults as well. So their study cohorts obviously are much smaller, quite often a subject N of one, but nonetheless, they form case studies that when you put them together, the evidence starts to mount. It's a bit like a detective trying to solve a murder case. If you keep getting the same answer through different investigations, the evidence slowly becomes very, very convincing. Mm-hmm. So the body in balance would be another principle that we see in as part of this whole injury resilience rubric. So don't be too flexible, but be flexible enough that you're not stressing your joints, say, tying your shoe or something like that. But to be overly flexible, in fact, the more flexibility you have, you actually have a higher risk of future back episodes. And I can explain why from a mechanistic point of view, if you like. Another potent mixture that we've documented in line workers, you know, the fellows who are out stringing up power lines and repairing them after storms and that kind of thing. And also we looked at auto manufacturers, guys who are chroming car bumpers, and they weigh about 70 pounds, and we followed them for a while as well. And what we found was the really strong workers actually had a higher risk of back injury. So, you know, there are many rehab programs that focus on back strength, but what we found was those who had more endurance relative to their strength actually had much higher injury resilience. And the mechanism turned out to be the ones who had more endurance, even though they weren't as strong, could lift, climb poles, lift these car bumpers in a style that spared their joints over and over and over again. Think of the last time you hurt yourself. You were probably out of position and you performed an exertion. So what we found with the guys who would have repeated very acute episodes throughout the year and then times where they were perfectly fine, they were actually stronger, but they tired faster, broke form faster, and that was the time that they got hurt. So there was it turned out to be an optimal ratio between strength and endurance, and for a healthy back, you actually wanted more endurance.
Yeah, I think it's just it's fascinating to me that when we really do the research that a lot of the walls start crumbling about what our intuition tells us. And it's one of the things that's very fascinating when you really delve into it and get the evidence. You've most recently written a book called Back Mechanic, which I have a copy of in front of me. And what I like is you have a very logical approach to addressing people who have problems with their back and then providing the answers. I kind of summarized it in a five-step process that I have. I'm not sure that's exactly what you used in Back Mechanic, because I've read several of your books and a lot of stuff on the internet. But I would be interested in perhaps talking briefly about the book Back Mechanic for those listeners, and also talking about the your approach, if you don't mind.
Sure, I'd love to. Prior to Back Mechanic, I'd written two different books for clinicians, and admittedly, they're a tough read. they're quite dense books. Now, the lay public were buying them. They'd tell me, "Man, this is a very dense book. Could you write one for us?" So, the most difficult book I've ever written was Back Mechanic, because the target really was the lay public. But to my surprise, the clinicians told me, "Wow, we like this book. We find it more consumable than your others." I'll just give you a little bit of background, and then we can talk about the steps. There was an agent from New York who asked, could she shop this book around to the big publishing houses in the U.S.? And every single publishing house said, "You must have a title like 5 Easy Steps to Cure Back Pain." And my response was always, "This is a lie. That has no integrity. It's not possible. Anyone who says you can cure back pain in 5 Easy Steps is not truthful." So I said, to hell with it. I'm going to self-publish it, keep the integrity. But now the challenge became, how much do I compromise to make it consumable and still have the integrity? So that's how Back Mechanic came about. There's actually 17 chapters, and they're short, as I think you can vouch for. But it really was a step-by-step process that started with providing an understanding of these mechanisms that cause back pain, and the reader will realize from that there isn't a single mechanism. And just because your neighbor who had back pain was cured with one approach, it doesn't mean that approach will work for you or your son or whoever. So that's the purpose of the first bit. But then I take the reader through a self-assessment of their pain triggers. So we could have fun with the political commentary on this, I suppose, but it's not any single physician's fault, but the fact of the matter is they only get 10 or 15 minutes to be with a patient who comes in with back pain, and they've got to give them some kind of advice. So it's not possible to spend the time to assess that person to determine their very specific pain triggers. Back pain has a cause. There's no such thing as non-specific back pain. So I tried to come up with the most essential tests that were simple enough that a person could do it to themselves, so put themselves into specific postures, create specific loads, and determine whether it hurt or not. And then, when it caused pain, do the opposite, and I coach the reader through that to see if it takes the pain away. So they start to get an idea for the first time that they are in control of their back pain, which is very liberating for them. They never understood that why they'd be brushing their teeth once in a while, this would feel as though someone thrust a knife in their back. But now they become savvy and aware of that. Well, the next stage, I'm sure you get asked a lot, is, can you give me an exercise for back pain? And I say, well, no, and that's not even the first step. After you have assessed the patient and determined the very precise pain trigger, the first thing you must do is remove that, remove the cause. Forget about exercise. It's like someone who hits their thumb with a hammer and then say, here, add these exercises, and if that's going to help their thumb, the only thing that will help is take the hammer away. So once they've learned their pain triggers, they must desensitize the wound-up tissue. And you do that by taking the hammer away or moving in a way that doesn't replicate the pain trigger. Slowly, and there's a very rich neuroscience on this, let the threshold of the pain-triggering organ and tissue, whatever that happens to be, increase its firing threshold. So it actually desensitizes. That in of itself is huge in reducing the sensitivity in a person's back. Once they've desensitized, now we can start to create a foundation for pain-free movement with very specific exercises, and they form an algorithm for a reason. First thing, move in a way that's joint sparing. So we show how to get on and off the toilet, in and out of a chair, how to brush your teeth, how to tie your shoe, how to sneeze. All of these activities that patients report, you know, I sneezed and threw my back out. Well, had they been savvy, that wouldn't have happened. Then we build a body in balance in the stability-mobility continuum. So one of the tests determines if they have unstable joints in their back, and micro-movements actually trigger their pain. Well, then they would be candidates for spine stability exercise. Some will have stiff hips. Some have stiff hips because of arthritis. They can't really get more mobility out of their hips without triggering the arthritis symptoms. So, you know, you take what you can get here. But then we then build those programs in an endurance philosophy, not worrying about strength yet. They will get stronger, but if you train strength, you actually take a risk that you don't need to. So train endurance with these very specific exercises, and then move on to strength if you feel you aren't strong enough after doing all of these things. So, you know, we've heard our surgical colleagues tell patients, oh, if you go to Pilates class or go take yoga and see if that helps your back. And this is just beyond belief to me. It just doesn't show an appreciation that some of those yoga exercises might be exactly what the patient would benefit from. Yet other exercises are precisely their pain triggers. So the philosophy is so mixed up, they don't know what's helping and what's hurting. So anyway, I hope that pretty much summarizes back mechanic.
Yeah, I think you've taken it to a very deep understanding, and I can certainly appreciate that all of us as physicians, and even some of us who may be very much specialized, may not still have the detailed understanding of what's happening with the back pain, which you're helping us come along and understand. One of the things that I realized, Dr. McGill, that I didn't do as we hurried into the program is I have not given our email address and phone number. And I think the appropriate thing for me to do right now would be to go ahead and take our break where I'll give our number and so forth. And then we'll come back and start talking about, I've got a couple of emails that came in before the program even started, and a personal back problem, and let you talk about those a little bit as we maybe and hopefully get some phone calls. So let me remind listeners, if you'll just stay right where you are, we'll be right back with you. But you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. Our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take about a one-minute break and continue our discussion with Dr. Stuart McGill. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, Your Health Connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Dr. Stuart McGill. Dr. McGill is a professor of spine biomechanics and director of the Spine Biomechanics Laboratory at the University of Waterloo in Ontario, Canada. We're discussing back pain, particularly low back pain, and we've really gone through an understanding of the detail with which Dr. McGill has studied and understands and is really educating everyone, the public as well as physicians and other people involved in the care of back problems, in the prevention, the mechanisms of the pain, and rehabilitation. We have not taken any real questions yet, and if you have questions, we have about 30 minutes to do that. You can email them to line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call locally at 550-8433. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. So let me open up the program with an email that I got a couple of days ago, Dr. McGill. And it says, Dr. Stuart McGill has intelligently and scientifically defined back problems and developed reliable ways of coping with back pain. I personally use his therapeutic exercises and teach them in my body work practice. But I have trouble keeping my clients engaged during the slow, tedious weeks, sometimes as long as a couple of months before they show rewarding benefits. Could Dr. McGill address the issue, that issue, and perhaps tell us how he coaches clients to stay on course?
Well, what I try and do is I pull a rabbit out of the hat if I can. And what I mean by that is I try and do something that's very perceivable in the patient that will get an immediate result. Let me give you an example. So say we have a patient who presents with a dynamic disc bulge. And what I mean by that is they can go for a long walk without symptoms. In fact, that is therapeutic. But if they sit in front of their computer for 20 minutes, their grumpiness in their low back starts, their right great toe might start to go numb, a little bit of radiating symptoms into the hamstring area, etc. So, and yet when they get up and walk around, that decreases. So I think if I put them into a sitting flexed posture and ask them to pull up on a chair, that would increase their symptoms, showing that there's an open fissure in the posterior part of their disc so that when we pressurize the nucleus, it will track through and it will actually increase the size of the bulge. What I would then do is say, lay on your tummy, put your hands palms down under your chin, and let's just breathe. As you exhale, focus on relaxing your low back into the table. That in of itself is a very gentle extension mechanism that starts to vacuum. Well, it actually isn't a vacuum yet, but it takes the pressure off the posterior disc bulge. If they start to say, you know, I'm feeling better already, that's easing my pain, good, I've just taught them to be in control. But they might say, you know, this is hurting me. And then what I will do is I will take their ankles from behind and I'll wiggle them side to side. And they might say, oh, you just helped me. Or they might say, oh, no, my back is feeling more sick. Then I will say, push your right eyebrow down into the table. Oh, doc, you're magical. That just took my pain away. So what I'm doing is probing. And I'm probing to see when I ask them to push their eyebrow 1 or 2 pounds, that just added anterior chain stability, and that took their pain away. And when I rattled their feet, that was destabilizing, showing me how stable or unstable the joint is. So I just keep probing, playing with tricks, manipulating stability, manipulating mobility, manipulating the micro movements. And again, keep converging with that patient and show them we will find a way to reduce that mechanical pain. And so I don't know if that's really the answer you're looking for, but that is how I handle it. I keep showing them the next step. Now let's brush your teeth without getting that familiar numbness. And we will, you're familiar with that short stop squat out of the book. I might coach that. And we'll just hone the precision of the spine curve, teaching them don't lift with your back stiffen your back and pull your hips through, all these coaching instructions that you might consider it entertainment for those 2 months, but I don't. I think it's a very systematic approach using sound mechanical principles and neurological principles, and keep making headway. So that's my answer.
Okay, thank you. We're going to take a caller. Don, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Yes, sir. Well, the man is right on target. My biggest question, I'm telling you from my own experience now, I've got degenerative spinal arthritis, known about it for decades, used to be on a railroad, among other things, and I'm 75 now, and I still get people that say, how do you cope? Well, my biggest curiosity is whether or not, and if so, how much do they figure we're going to maybe get from stem cell research? But as far as the exercise that he's been talking about, I agree with him 100%. You've got to do your own fishing. You got to find out what does and does not help you. And a lot of people don't want to believe it. They'd rather sit back and pop a bunch of pills and see if the answer's there. And I keep trying to tell them, take the time to get to know yourself better and you know, see what you can do before you start grabbing a pill bottle or begging for a prescription or something. Because we learned this right away in scuba training back in the 60s with the fire department, and that was water deadens your senses. So if you're going to go get in the water, you have to pay exceptionally close attention to what your sense of touch is. If you brush something like down the bottom of a quarry or something, like barbed wire, or go inside of a wrecked vehicle down there, you get a little cut or something, no big problem if you're in fresh water. But if you're out in the ocean and something like that happens, shark can smell that 2 miles away.
Don, I'm going to go. Thanks for your call. Let me have Dr. McGill answer your concerns, questions about particularly what he knows about stem cell research or your comments about exercise. Thanks for your call. Dr. McGill?
Yeah, I don't have any expertise at all with stem cells.
Okay, all right. Let me go ahead and take another email call or email that came in. And this is an individual who says, I'm a healthy male, took a hard fall on the ice, broke my femur, then had a total hip replacement. And currently I'm having chronic pain at the iliac crest at about the level of L4, he says. So iliac crest pain after a hip replacement. Any thoughts for someone like that?
Well, all I can say there, Dr. Woodard, is I would have to assess the person and determine their precise pain triggers. I'd work to make that iliac crest pain a slightly more uncomfortable. So I understood the mechanism. It might be a quadratus lumborum attachment.
Right.
It could be referred pain. But I would make it worse, understand the mechanism, and then engineer a movement pattern to avoid whatever that was. Now, occasionally we will get patients where the pain triggers are not mechanical, and I've found quite a few cases over the years of some sinister causes to back pain. They might be tumors or the like, and if provocative testing doesn't provoke the pain and I can't find a way to take it away, I'm starting to suspect non-mechanical causes. I want to see the MRs, etc. So that's all I can really say. I can't give a specific solution here, only an approach that I would use to investigate further.
Right. Along the similar line, let me just mention to the listeners, the quadratus lumborum is a muscle in your back, and I'd encourage people to take a look at some of the online pictures of the anatomy of the back, because I think it does help you follow a little bit more Dr. McGill's approach.
And I happened to be a physician, so I hurt my back swinging a club, hit the ground really hard, and suddenly had a pretty bad pain in my back, and went to the books. And I think it was my right quadratus lumboris. I got started doing that. I strained, and I started doing some of the exercises that you have promoted, some of the big three in particular, and got better. But then I stopped and felt, oh, I'm okay. I'm walking a lot. When I play golf, I walk. I should be fine. And I did the same darn thing again. I hit the ground a little bit too hard, and I immediately hurt my back and started back up again on the exercises. Now, my question is not to get a free consult from you necessarily. I'm interested in why is it that when you start doing, let's say, the exercises, say I'm right and I did the right exercise, what is it about that helps the pain and the injury resolve? And my thought process is that maybe it's just the injury is resolving itself and the exercise is just going along to prevent further injury. But it's just a common sense question. What's the mechanism going on there?
Well, here's my read on that. I doubt that your primary pathology there would actually be the QL, the quadratus lumborum. I would suspect the quadratus lumborum is going into a bit of a spasm in sympathy with something underneath. Now, it's so interesting, when we measure the role of individual muscles to stabilize a spine, despite some of the mythology we've been hearing, the muscle that is mostly activated in times of when stability for the spinal column is needed, it is number one, the quadratus lumborum. If you were a civil engineer building a tall tower, like a cell phone tower, you might have guy wires down to the ground. You might put out spreaders like on a ship's mast and connect the tips of the spreaders with cables because that's the most effective way to stabilize that tower. I just described quadratus lumborum. Connects the bottom ribs to the transverse processes of every lumbar level and connects to the iliac crest on the bottom. So it's designed to be a real primary stabilizer of the spine. So what I suspect happened in your case, I'd love to test it and see you, is that the QL was in sympathy to something underneath. Now, when you do the big three exercises, the side plank in particular, it targets just one QL, not both, because that would double the compressive penalty to the spine in doing the exercise. But to do an isometric side plank causes a stiffness in that QL that, as I said earlier, stays with the person for an hour or two or even three. And that will engineer out the micro movements, which I suspect you tweaked the joint just a little bit when your club hit the ground. Mm-hmm. A little micro movement triggered the pain, but that big stabilizer, the QL, and all of the other, the obliques and the erectors and rectus, etc. When you stiffened those by doing those planking style of exercises, you got a relief that lasted a few hours. I might also state at this point, Dr. Woodard, is people don't realize just how critical a quadratus lumborum is. You might find this entertaining. We measured World Strongmen competitors while they were carrying extreme loads. One was a super yoked task where they put hundreds of pounds on a bar across their back and they have to see how far they can carry it. We measured the hip abduction strength, which is that was what was thought allowed you to walk and carry heavy loads. In this one particular athlete who actually won the competition, we measured 500 newton meters of hip AB strength, abduction strength. But to do the task and win, he needed 750 newton meters. Where was the missing strength? It turned out it was quadratus lumborum on the other side. And if you've ever had the unfortunate patient, usually children, occasionally you'll get a child with a paralyzed unilateral quadratus lumborum. The first thing they have extreme difficulty doing is walking, because imagine this, if you were walking and your stance leg is your left leg, your right leg is the swing leg, the right quadratus lumborum helps hold up the pelvic platform to allow right leg swing. But assuming if that was paralyzed or not able to be activated for some reason, that whole pelvis would drop to the right side on the swing leg side, and it would actually collapse into the ground. So again, just showing what a critical muscle that is for function, for something as simple as walking or gait, how it is a primary stabilizer, and its major role in spine health. And by the way, another little anecdote: I am probably the first person in the world to have electrodes implanted in their quadratus lumborum, and we actually did it by mistake. We were going for deep psoas, and the cannula goes through the erector spinae through quadratus and gets hooked into deep psoas, and one of the electrodes withdrew by accident into QL, and we were practicing on ourselves doing this 24 years ago. Or 23 years ago in Switzerland. And it was amazing how it doesn't matter whether you do a sit-up, you walk, you run, you ride a bike, you do an extensor task or a side plank, quadratus lumborum is always highly active. Huh. Or if you were just to stand up nice and tall and carry a suitcase, quadratus lumborum, huge muscle.
All right. Thank you. We have a ton of phone calls. We're not going to get to all of them, but let's try another one. Jessica, you're on line one.
Hi. I was recently started working out again after a long absence, and working my core, I ended up with some pretty bad back and hip pain. And when I went to physical therapy for the first time, they kind of diagnosed me with joint hypermobility syndrome. And I was just curious what the doctor thought about the effect of joint hypermobility syndrome on trying to build core and back strength and stability.
Okay. Thanks for your call.
Well, again, to give good advice, I really would have to assess you and see how hypermobile you were and whether or not it was part of your pain-triggering mechanism. I would also want to assess your general movement patterns and see if you were triggering pain because of you using excessive spine mobility when you move. If I had a read on both of those things, I could give you probably a much more select and ideal stabilization and core fitness program. What did they have you doing?
You still with us, Jessica? Oh, she has. She left us. She hung up, Dr. McGill.
Okay.
All right. Well, let's talk about your core. You've mentioned your big three exercises. Do you mind describing those and talk about when to use them, when not to use them, perhaps, and why they're your big three?
Yes, of course. When we first started to research what exercises created the most stiffening stability to the spine, but in a way that spared the spine of load. In other words, what were the most tolerable for back pain patients? We looked at many, many different exercises, and the three that bubbled up to the top of spine sparing and maximum stability were what became known as the McGill modified curl up, and I'll explain that, the side plank, and then the bird dog or the quadruped. So one muscle was for the front, other for the side, and the third for the back. So now we've built a full guy wire system around the spine. The modified curl up is the person lays on their back, but they must not flatten their low back to the floor. This is common in some Pilates classes. Imprinting the back, it is a false stability, and it puts the spine in stress because it takes it out of its neutral curves. Instead, have the person put their hands palms down under their low back to achieve comfort and support a neutral spine. That's its least stressed position. Then bend one knee. That reduces neural tension and would help for anybody with a neural trap, a disc bulge or something like that. And then just lift the head and shoulders half an inch, no more. And then you hold it for 10 seconds. Not longer, not shorter. Very precisely 10 seconds. It avoids cramps to the muscle, but it is sufficient to stimulate the stiffening and the endurance adaptations that I was trying to advocate for earlier. Then for the side, there's a family of side planks. The person can lay on their side, get on their knees and one elbow, if you can imagine that from my description. And as the exercise progresses, they could actually go from their feet. Now, the story there is kind of interesting. A lot of people stack their feet. I wrote the first spine stability program with these exercises for the American College of Sports Medicine back in the early 90s, and the editor told me, well, we're behind. Just trust our artist to draw the exercises from your photographs. And the artist drew the feet stacked, and that's how it became the American College of Sports Medicine standard. And I specifically showed the top leg should always be in front so the person can roll to a front plank, and it also, when the feet are split, it unloads the spine a little bit because the person doesn't have to fight the tendency to roll. So it was actually spine sparing, but I've had people criticize me and say, don't you know the American College of Sports Medicine? You're arguing with their standards. And I said, yes, sir, I wrote them. But it was a mistake of an artist that resulted in that. Anyway, the third exercise for the back is the person gets on all fours. They lift one leg and the opposite arm out in front. Now, some people do this laying on their tummy. Nowhere near as good, because the tummy lay causes the spine to go into a hyperextension to allow a leg raise and a opposite arm raise. So, again, very precisely, we work to get the spine into a neutral position. We work on knee width, open up the hips, all these kinds of tricks to engineer the pain sensitivity out first, and then once again hold the exercise for 10 seconds. So those are the big three and where they all came from. Interestingly enough, there's several sports institutions in the U.S. that have now found you actually run faster and cut harder after doing a warm-up with the big three. It creates what we call proximal stability. The more proximal stability an athlete has in their core, the faster the distal limb movements. So the more you can lock down the core, the faster your leg movements if you're sprinting, the faster your arm and shoulder movements if you're in Alaska swinging an axe or training for MMA. It's a universal principle, proximal stability.
All right, so what I hear repeatedly is you want this spine to be neutral, not under stress, and you're building up the core muscles around the spine to keep it safe. That's the core idea that I hear keep coming back.
Well, yes and no.
Okay.
The answer is, once again, it depends.
Okay.
But here's the thing. You can't have it both ways. You can't have a really flexible spine and then turn around and expect it to bear high load. You got to pick one. So if you want to be a gymnast, do body weight exercises, don't lift heavy weights, and you will have a soft, pliable spine. But it won't be one designed to bear a lot of load. But if you want to carry logs, train with heavy weights, you need a much stiffer spine, and toughen the collagen of the discs. Every time you stretch it, you soften the collagen of the discs. So choose which approach you want, and I'm just going to take 2 minutes to describe why it depends. the thickness of the person's spine really matters. What I mean by that is if you take a thin willow branch, you can bend it back and forth, and there's no stress. It won't break because it's so thin. If you take a thicker branch and bend it to the same level, it shatters right away. The reason being the radial thickness, or the thickness of the rod, determines its stress. So we found with big boned people, they break their backs, damage the discs much sooner doing things like sit-ups and whatnot than slender people. But the slender people can't inherently handle the bigger loads. Also, people have ovoid discs. When you look at them, if you slice their spine through transversely, like in an MRI scan, some have ovoid discs and some have limacon shaped, which are shaped like a lima bean. You won't find golfers with big limacon discs. In other words, you won't find a middle linebacker who can hit a long golf ball. They don't exist. And the reason is their spines are too big and thick. The stresses are too much. It's so much more of an advantage to have a slender spine. So anyway, there you go. Once again, in the answer is it depends. Pick the approach, match it to what you want to do, and don't mix up the philosophies. And chances are you have a much better chance of avoiding pain and getting higher performance.
We've only got about 2 minutes or so left, and we won't get to all our callers, and I want to apologize, but it really sounds like you're so specialized. You want to be able to really examine and watch people and follow those approaches that we've summarized earlier, and we can steer people to your book, Back Mechanic, for some help with that. But before we get done, I want to also ask you about walking and where you stand on the importance of walking for good back health.
Walking is non-negotiable. It's absolutely essential for back health. Now, if a person is very tender, and they trigger pain quite easily, we might have them walk every 20 minutes. Just get out of their chair, walk to the end of the room and back. And they do that every 20 minutes. Slowly, they will be able to walk, say, 10 minutes, and then I want them to do that 3 times a day, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. But walking, it's the only way to really begin a progression involving quadratus lumborum and the stabilizing muscles. Walk fast, heel to toe, swinging the arms about the shoulders. But once again, there's a whole chapter in the book on the mechanics of walking, how to store and recover elastic energy through walking style, and turn walking into a very powerful therapy.
All right. Thanks again for taking the time. Let me remind listeners, you can go to alaskapublic.org, click the Line 1 link. You'll see the program notes for today's show. You can get a link to Dr. McGill's blog, My Rehab Exercise. His book is Back, Back Mechanic. And I would encourage you to get on the internet and look at a lot of the information you can find about the work Dr. McGill's doing. Dr. McGill, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Yeah, thank you. And if I can just say, they can get the book from backfitpro.com or Amazon.
Okay. Thank you very much. Think about the national blood shortage, and we'll be discussing that Monday, August 8th. Thank you very much for listening today. And thanks to Ron Zastro, who audio engineered today's program. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.